Good morning, everybody, or good evening, wherever you are. This is Hans Hoogervorst. I would first like to do a roll call to see if everybody is here. I think I've heard Françoise Flores.
Yes.
Roger Marshall.
Yeah.
Is Liesel Knorr there?
A very good afternoon.
Very good. Hi, Liesel. Anna Martinez Pina.
Yes, good afternoon. Good.
Alexandru Breudel. Well, Brazil still absent. Ras Golden.
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, hi, Ras. Linda Miesen.
Yes, I'm here, Hans.
Okay. Clement Chang. Kevin Stevenson.
Yes.
Ikuo Nishikawa, I heard him.
I'm here, yes. Thank you.
And Yu Guangzong, we heard too. So,
we are here.
Okay, very good.
And Hans, I was expecting that Mike Ashley would be on the call.
Okay.
I am.
Okay, hi Mike. So we are more or less complete. We only have 1 hour, so let's use it to the maximum extent possible. May I remind you that this is a public meeting, so people are listening if they're interested. We organized this conference call to be able to give you the first feedback that the IFB staff has received on our impairment proposals. And I will ask Sue Lloyd to give us a brief presentation on that. And after that presentation, we will also be very happy to hear your first impressions. So, is that agreed with you? And can I give the floor to Sue Lloyd?
Yes.
Okay, Sue.
Thanks, Hans. Hello, everybody. So what I'll do just to structure the conversation, given it's a little bit difficult on the phone, is walk through the slides that we have distributed to you as a basis for the discussion. And I want to go through our preliminary feedback. It's only preliminary because the comment letter period only ends this Friday. But I'll also be particularly interested to get your thoughts and observations and whether you have any alternative information that you've heard in your various jurisdictions. So the information I'll provide you today basically summarises the feedback we've received from the outreach meetings that we've undertaken so far with various constituents, and it also summarises the initial feedback we've got from some of the comment letters and the preliminary analysis from our fieldwork. And what I'll do, so that you don't have to listen to me for too long, is I'll go through to slide 7 and then we'll stop for comments and then we'll go through the rest of the presentation after that. So looking first at page 3 of the slide deck and the main messages that we've received. Generally speaking, I think we can say that so far the vast majority of our constituents support a model that distinguishes between financial assets that have deteriorated in credit quality and those that haven't. And generally respondents have supported this approach because they think it's aligned with the economics of lending, it's closely aligned to their credit risk management practices, and they believe that operationally it's more realistic and reliable to measure lifetime expected credit losses only on items that have deteriorated in credit quality. The majority of preparers that we've spoken to so far consider that the proposals in our exposure draft are challenging to apply, but that they can be made operational. And they can be made operational because they can build on existing data and model that they already use for credit risk management purposes. While the majority of non-US users support a model that distinguishes assets that have deteriorated and those that haven't, I think it's fair to say that the majority of US users of financial statements have expressed preference for a model where lifetime expected credit losses are always recognised. And they seem to prefer that because reserve adequacy is important to them. So overall, our conclusion so far is that there is a lot of support for our model. Having said that, convergence is still very important to people. A lot of people are asking for that. But unfortunately, we haven't got too many suggestions for how to converge with the FASB, although some have suggested moving forward with a model that builds on a distinction between good assets and other assets. Moving now to page 4 and the stage 1 allowance. Again, generally respondents support the 12-month expected credit loss measure that's in our exposure draft. Most, however, agree with us that there's no real conceptual basis for the 12-month measure, but most of our constituents, including users that we've spoken to, support the 12-month measure as a proxy to adjust interest revenue for initial loss expectations, and I also see it as a practical way to try to balance the cost of implementation and the benefits of the information provided. The support that we're getting from preparers seems to be based on the fact they can build on their existing regulatory data, their budgeting cycle, and also they think it's more reliable for them to determine the risk of a default occurring in a 12-month period. But we don't have full support for the Stage 1 allowance, and in particular, we still have jurisdictional differences. So many US respondents are concerned that a 12-month expected loss could result in the allowance balances being insufficient. In addition, there are concerns that some have raised that the 12-month expected loss measure and the interaction with significant deterioration, as it's worded in our proposals, isn't responsive enough to changes in conditions that affect credit risk, and it doesn't capture adequately expected losses on loans that have late loss patterns. Moving now to significant deterioration, which I'll discuss in the next few slides before we open it up for your comments. So on page 5. Many of the users of financial statements that we've spoken to find information about assets that have deteriorated significantly in credit quality and those that haven't beneficial to their analysis of the financial statements. And preparers also have supported the notion of moving financial instruments to lifetime expected credit losses on an assessment of significant deterioration. Preparers have said they need to use significant judgment to make the decision, and they would need to enhance their current systems to apply the model, but they have said that they can leverage on their existing infrastructure and credit risk information to implement the proposal. There is some concern with the way that we've worded the assessment of significant deterioration in the proposals. In particular, some think that we're proposing that the probability of default be explicitly calculated for all assets, but that was not our intention. Importantly, some of the audit firms have expressed their support for recognising lifetime expected losses based on significant deterioration in credit quality. However, they would like us to provide additional guidance, and in particular, they've suggested that the model should more explicitly address how to deal with assets that have experienced a significant increase in credit risk, but where that can't be identified on an individual asset basis. Looking now at page 6 and the low credit risk simplification that we've got in the proposals. Most preparers support the simplification for low credit risk instruments. However, some security regulators and prudential regulators don't, and they would prefer that the model is applied consistently based on significant deterioration, regardless of the risk of the assets. Preparers, especially insurance companies, support the simplification because they think it will make the model much more operational. But I think it's fair to say that some preparers are interpreting this exception as being much broader in its effect than the board had intended and are, for example, assuming it could be broadly applied to retail. The last thing I'll touch on before I open up is the rebuttable presumption, which is set out on page 7 of the slide deck. Users generally have supported, the users we've spoken to have generally supported the 30-day past due presumption of significant deterioration on the basis that it would increase comparability in the application of the model. Preparers also support this simplification, mainly because they think it will help them make the model operational for their retail assets. And some have said that it would work well if they were to consider 30 days past due plus other information such as restructuring information. Worryingly, from a staff perspective, many banks have said that they would only consider delinquency information in determining the move to lifetime losses. And the staff think that we'd need to address this because delinquency in isolation is not, in our view, sufficiently forward-looking. Also, regulators are concerned that the model is not as forward-looking as they had hoped, not as responsive to changes in economic conditions as they had hoped, and they have requested that we clarify that current macroeconomic conditions and forecasts of future events be considered in assessing deterioration, even if no borrower-specific information indicates significant credit deterioration. So with that, I'll stop there and hand over to Hans to get feedback and thoughts on that initial feedback.
Okay. After this introduction by Sue, I'm happy to open up the floor for comments, questions, impressions.
This is Ikoniska from ASBJ. We are supportive of the model that distinguishes financial assets into two. However, we think that further improvement is still necessary, primarily for two reasons. First, the proposed model would not be necessarily reasonable because levels of provisions required to the loans for the same borrowers could differ depending on when they were originated. For example, the original after the original loan was moved to the stage two, then the additional loan was made. Those two loans are exactly the same from the point of entity's source of repayment. In addition, financial statement preparers expressed significant concern that the proposed model is not operational, as it requires tracking of the credit risks on an instrument-to-instrument basis. So therefore, we believe that classification should be based on the borrower's information as at each reporting date. So in our comment later, we are proposing the ASBJ's alternative approach. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's a comment a few people have raised, and we'll be looking at it. At the moment, the board's view has been that if you originated at different times, even to the same obligor, the assessment of deterioration should reflect the different climate of origination.
We can't hear you, Sue, over the music.
It appears that someone has put their handsets on hold, which introduces hold music.
Yes.
So can you unmute your individual handsets and press star 6, please?
Obviously,
that
person is not listening
now. It's not us. Hello, this is an announcement for the call. Please, would you unmute your individual handset and press star 6? Thank you.
Very good.
Okay, thank you. So I was saying that some others have also raised that point, so we will be looking at the operational challenges and trying to balance that against the deterioration concept and the redeliberation.
Okay. Who else might like to express their views?
Hans and Sue, it's Linda Mizan from Canada. So I think that our regional outreach would indicate that we are fairly consistent with what you've heard. I think there is still some conceptual discomfort over the standard being so focused essentially, quote, on one industry. So there is some concern that this seems to be inordinately targeted at financial institutions versus other preparers. But, I think people understand the background and the reason for that. I think we also have what I think is a consistent point with the last speaker, relative to the so-called, it's the relative versus the absolute approach. I think there's a fair amount of discomfort over the possibility that a similar asset could either end up in stage one or stage two, depending on how you interpret an approach under the relative approach versus the absolute approach, and there's a lot of intuitive appeal to the people we're talking to about the notion of this is the credit, rating or whatever the metric is at the end of the period, take that snapshot and apply accordingly. So I think that's also what we're hearing. There is an acceptance of the 12-month period as a, quote, practical expedient. There is a view that and perhaps there is some other period that is more appropriate, but they understand the background for the so-called practical expedient. But I think in general, what you would hear from our stakeholders and what you will see in our comment letter is that given where we have been and the journey we've been on, there is support for where we landed, albeit concerns about how it fits, how it is supported conceptually from a conceptual framework perspective.
Okay, thank you. So does that mean with your reference to absolute that in Canada you would think that all loans that are originated of low quality should go straight to lifetime expected losses?
I think that people have not phrased it exactly that way, Sue, but as we continue our discussions, I think that they're getting closer to that than they have been in the past. I think it's become an operational necessity as opposed to anything else.
Anybody?
Hans.
Yes.
Hans, it's Clement Chen from Hong Kong.
Yes, Clement.
Yeah, on this thing, you know, first things that I like to bring up is a lot of our members actually are having concern about this day one approach of 12-month expected loss recognition due to the lack of conceptual backing. Although we understand that it is a compromise from the complex model submitted in 2012 ED. The other major sort of concern expressed is about the lack of tracing the credit risk continuously since day one in our region. Appears that a lot of our respondents and constituents are telling us that when we are talking about monitoring the credit risk for the financial instruments on a portfolio basis, at best, most of the players in the market are monitoring it on a portfolio basis rather than on an individual instrument basis. So for that, in order to, you know, sort of monitoring the credit risk so as to recognize the deterioration, the significant deterioration to trigger off the lifetime expected loss model, in general, we are having a feeling that it create a lot of operational challenges and difficulties in our region.
Well, I think this is one of the things that we will have to clarify or make much more clear than it has been thus far, that we do expect banks to look at large portfolios on a portfolio basis. Obviously, when you have a rapidly worsening economy and rising interest rates, loan to values going up very sharply, you should not be waiting for delinquencies on an individual basis to take place before assessing that at least a part of your portfolio has to move to stage two, because there has been a significant deterioration in credit risk. And I think we have to make clear that we should make that analysis on a portfolio basis rather than on an individual delinquency basis.
Yeah.
Hands of Kevin here.
Yes.
What our banks do is to classify their customers by credit rating. So rather than by instrument, it's by customer. So one customer may have a number of dealings with the bank. And those classifications apply over a gradient of, say, 12 to 15 categories. And so at any particular point in time, they look at the amount that is in each grading and then they'll apply a loss factor to that to arrive at their provision. Until now, that loss factor has been on an incurred basis, but could, under the proposed model, be adapted to an expected basis. By doing it in that way, they don't actually trace the history of the credit for an individual, or indeed even for an individual customer. Everything depends on which class they are then put into as to what loss they're going to get. Now, it seems to me that that's an approach that can meet your objectives and overcome the tracking problems, which our preparers are telling us are significant issues, and they are not, it's not they currently manage credit risk. They do it more on a what you might call a sub-portfolio basis, having analysed everybody into known credit risk categories. So that's one issue that we have. I guess the other thing that is concerning us, and similar to what Clement said, is, and what Sue acknowledged, is the lack of logic behind the 12-month approach. Now, it's very hard to get meaning across to somebody if you don't have a logic behind it. And so what we've been trying to understand is some way that you could rationalise that 12-month loss so that people could better understand what it is. Why do we feel the need to have that loss? And I guess our line of thinking is that when a loan is written originally, the amount and the interest rate involved in it are reflective of the fair value of the transaction at that point. So we would have thought that, and therefore the carrying amount being discounted at the effective interest rate is already net of concerns about credit risk, because that's part of the pricing of the original deal. So the next step is, when would you then need to make a provision? And the answer in theory should be when there's something unexpected that transpires. Now, you might make the logic that nobody writes a loan with the expectation that there'll be default in the first year. And maybe that's a basis for saying, you know, we're going to have 12-month losses. I think that logic is a bit flimsy, but I think there should at least be some articulation of the reason for the 12-month loss. So that people are stumbling with that, and, you know, we're criticised generally for accounting being arcane. If we can't say what it means and all we can say is that it's arbitrary, it's not particularly helpful to anybody.
Mm.
The third point we would make is that from that same logic, we would reject the FASB approach, because we think that's the ultimate double count, and we can't see any logic for doing it in the way in which they propose. In the model that the Australian banks follow, every time somebody gets reclassified from one category to another category, there would be an adjustment to the provision, because every credit category has a different pricing implication. Now, if your significant deterioration could be equated to the principle that the loan would now be written on a different basis if written today, we would be perfectly happy with significant deterioration. If it means something other than that, we're not sure what it does mean.
Okay, and just to respond to that last point, Kevin, I think that at its heart, that is what we do mean by significant deterioration. If I were to lend again today, would I do it on the same terms, or has there been a change in the credit expectations such that I'd want to do something differently? So I think that the idea of sort of looking at whether or not somebody has reassessed the internal risk rating, if you like, for a particular customer is absolutely the sort of logic we would think should underlie the application of the proposal.
Well, I think our banks would cheer if that was said explicitly in the document. It does have a consequence, though, that one of the things that struck them as strange is that if you went from the top in quality, say AAA whatever, to any other category that was still investment grade, they think it should still change your provision. So they don't see any merit in dividing a line between investment grade and others. It is stick to principle. If you'd write it at a different price, it gets a different provision.
Okay.
Yeah.
We
on a similar note, On a similar note, it's Clement. On a similar note, I think there is also concern expressed about the lack of guidance on the event of a significant increase in credit risk, and as well as the definition of investment grade assets, because a couple of expressions coming through saying that it will be equally operational challenging to try to differentiate investment grade assets from non-investment grade assets.
Did you want to get back to Kevin's earlier example of this loan moving from AAA, let's say, to the bottom of investment grade?
A few people have raised that same point about not thinking that it's appropriate to sort of have a different way of thinking about moving to lifetime just because something's sort of still high quality and they use the AAA to BBB type scenario. I guess the only thing I was going to point out was you would update your loss allowance for the fact that you've changed in credit quality. It just remains a 12-month measure rather than a lifetime measure. But certainly we will be looking at that feedback. Most people like the fact that it makes the tracking less onerous, but there certainly is a camp that would share those concerns that you expressed from Australia.
Thanks, Sue.
Hans, it's Roger. Can I give a couple of comments?
Yes, please.
First of all, I'd like to agree with Kevin on several things. One is, I do agree that moving from a AAA to AAA to a BBB, the bank would originally have priced that completely differently. So there is an economic loss. In fact, the expectation of losses over the next 12 months may still be insignificant, but I do feel that that will be a time to recognise that economic loss. And so I'd be in that camp. Secondly, I agree with Chetan that conceptually it's very hard to justify the 12 months. I think we accept it as a practical expedient. If this is the price of going there, then let's do it. But it is hard to justify. And for similar reasons to Kevin, we would not support the Fountain model at all, which I think would accentuate the conceptual problem. Thirdly, no one mentioned the interest rates yet. I think it would be good to see a narrowing of the range of possibilities for discounting. I think it's going to be difficult to compare different banks if they're all using very different discount rates. And I think that is probably the biggest example, or one of the examples, of a number of quite large flexibilities in the model. Now, I'm all for principle-based standards, but I'm concerned here that we're going to find regulators narrowing down the range of options if we don't do it ourselves. So I'd like to see a narrowing on discount rates on other areas.
I was going to come on to that in a moment, but I'll touch on it given that you've raised it. A number of people have said that they think that the effect of the choice of the range of discount rates in the document can have very material effects, particularly in jurisdictions with a range of interest rates, and so they've raised concerns about the lack of comparability that we would end up with due to the choice of discount rates. I think from a staff perspective, it's fair to say that when we put that flexibility in the document as an operational expedient, it was sort of on the naive, perhaps, assumption that it wasn't going to have a big effect on the numbers. That's now not the feedback that we're getting. So I think that we'll have to reconsider whether it's appropriate to have that spectrum of choice of interest rates if it's going to have such a big effect on what the actual allowance balance could be.
I would like to come in there just very briefly to say that we had the concern about what you had on slide 9, but then we have to bring in the cash flows too so that you make sure that people are seeing the interest rate and what kind of you price in already somewhat together, because to only look at the discount rate or to only look at the cash flows might end up with double counting or not counting or whatever. So don't look at one of these pieces in isolation.
Yeah.
Just before we go on to slide 9, it's Mike. Can I just clarify one thing with Roger and Kevin, though? Because this moving from AAA to BBB, which Sue mentioned, a number of people have raised, I do question whether it's appropriate to move something to lifetime expected losses when it's moved from AAA to BBB, and I just wanted to clarify whether that's what they were asking for or whether they were just asking for a reassessment of the 12-month expected loss, which, as Sue said, is in the model.
Kevin. In theory, we would say that every time a loan gets reclassified from one credit risk category to another, and therefore would be written at a different price, you should be adjusting your provision, either up or down, subject to a cap that's not going above the historical written down amount. And from that viewpoint, we're not sure why you would want a 12-month arrangement. Whenever the change causes reclassification, surely you just take the consequence. And the only solace I was trying to give is if you could make an argument that defaults in the first 12 months would never be part of the expected deal when you wrote the loan, then maybe you could argue that those 12-month ones were all unexpected and that maybe you didn't know anything better beyond that point. But I think that logic is a bit skinny.
I think a number of banks would find it operationally quite difficult to move to lifetime expected just because there was a minor deterioration, say, from AAA down to AA. And the reason, frankly, is that whilst you're right, you might price it slightly differently, you're still going to be covered largely for the credit risk because it's still pretty small. And therefore, to move to a full lifetime loss seems somewhat inappropriate given the stream of interest income you would still expect even on the old pricing.
But you would expect a loss on every category of credit rating, wouldn't you?
You would expect a loss, but your note provide for a loss on everything.
Why not?
Well, sorry, lifetime expected losses. You don't provide for the lifetime expected losses because you expect the interest income to cover it.
therein lies the rub, I think.
Correct.
Yes, Sue?
Shall I go on to slide 8? So moving forward to slide 8 and the measurement of lifetime expected credit losses. Firstly, I don't think that anybody has disagreed that lifetime expected credit losses should be recognised for items that have deteriorated significantly in 2020. However, many have said that measuring lifetime expected credit losses for all of their assets would be operationally complex, especially for long-lived performing loans, and have questioned the reliability of any estimates as they would have little or no specific asset data on which they could base their forecast lifetime losses for performing assets that have no signs of credit deterioration. Essentially, they're saying that once things start to deteriorate, they have more granular credit information, so the job becomes a little easier.
Mm.
Moving now to page 9 and some other issues that have been raised. I've already touched on the discount rate. On the discounting issue, respondents have generally agreed that expected credit losses should be calculated on a discounted basis, noting that that's consistent with the notion of amortized cost in IFRS, which is a present value concept. In addition to the comments on the discount rate, the other point that's been raised on the calculations is the definition of default. The document doesn't include a definition, and many, including regulators, have told us that they think we should define the notion of default that we want used, and that's at least in part because it sort of defines the scope of what's captured in the stage one measure, and so the default definition is viewed as being important. So that's something that we'll look at. On lease receivables and trade receivables, to the point that Linda raised earlier, I think that people are pleased that there are some practical expedients to at least make it a little bit simpler for people to apply that aren't corporate. Having said that, given that the simplification is that you can always recognise lifetime losses rather than going through the effort of calculating 12 months and assessing significant deterioration, having seen that the alternative is lifetime, I think a number of corporates have said they probably wouldn't actually use the simplification. I'm moving now to page 10, firstly, and looking at the user feedback on disclosures. As an overall comment, the users that we've spoken to have supported the proposed disclosures in the exposure draft. Perhaps unsurprisingly, they have, however, asked for more granular information. For example, they've asked for more detailed information about changes in the loss allowance within a measurement category and also the corresponding effect on profit or loss, and they've also asked for more information about the of items between stages. On transition, preparers have made a number of comments about asking us to look at some more practical approaches to help them to transition into the model. In particular, the exposure draft proposes that if you can't determine whether or not assets have deteriorated since their original recognition on transition into the model, the EG says that you should recognise lifetime losses on anything that is below investment grade, and many have said that they think that that's unduly onerous and they would like us to look at ways to estimate the amount of deterioration on transition. So they want us to be more adventurous there in trying to help them. We've got some initial feedback on the time that people think they'd need to apply the model. Most people have said they can see that we need to put the standard in place quickly, but they've also said that they think they need considerable lead time to implement the proposals, and so far a period of around 3 years seems to be the period that preparers are saying that they would need. The last thing I'll briefly touch on is field work. So in addition to the exposure draft and the comment letter process, we have been doing some field work. We're doing field work with a small group about 15 participants across different jurisdictions. It's a small number, largely because we're actually asking them to do something that's relatively onerous for them to do. We're asking them to run detailed numbers for us on the application of the model. And what we've asked them to do is to simulate what they think the effect of the proposals would be over a series of time for a particular portfolio of real assets. And we've asked them to do this to see how responsive the model is to changes in economic circumstances. It's also been done so that we get an idea from them about what the operational challenges would be of implementing the model, and also to give us some directional information about the likely magnitude of the allowance balances. The main feedback we've got from the fieldwork is set out on page 11, and it's broadly consistent with the overall summary that I've given you, but just touching on a couple of things. The first thing is that we're pleased that the model does seem to be responsive to changes in economic conditions, and importantly more responsive than the current incurred loss model. And also, as a general observation, the feedback that we have is that allowance balances would generally increase compared with IAS 39 today, although it is fair to say that the extent of the increase is very much influenced by the way in which the IBNR calculations are carried out under IAS 39 today, so the effect does differ by jurisdiction. So with that, does anybody have comments on those extra
things? Yeah, it's Alex from Brazil.
Yes, Alex.
Oh, hi. I have just to comment on the field work, as I've been involved in conducting one of those field works. And the first comment is, well, we agree that the model is operational, but at least in the case of large banks, it's extremely expensive to be implemented, and I don't know how costly this would be to other firms outside of the financial sector. It seems to me to be very expensive to implement the model. And so I think this model is operational. Yes, it can be implemented, but I really don't know how costly this is going to be on non-financial firms to have this kind of data, so kind of probabilities of default for 12 months and for lifetime. That I believe this for some firms will be really expensive. And the second one is this identifying relationship between macro factors and financial performance is a very tricky one. I can give you an example. For example, in the last 2 years in Brazil, we saw the lowest level of unemployment in history and the highest level of delinquency in the last 10 years. So it's it's very hard to come up with a model that gives you a decent relationship between macro models and actual delinquencies because of the dynamics of the product, dynamics of the market. So I'm a little bit afraid of that this connection would be too broad and people would do almost anything they want.
But
because it's very hard to come up with.
I think that Brazil has a bit of an unusual situation of having a very young mass consumer credit market where obviously people have, and banks have very little experience with this kind of credit. And it doesn't surprise me at all that delinquency is very high.
And
you can only imagine how high delinquency would be, including high unemployment.
And we have really, from other field tests, we have seen a very high correlation between these macroeconomic factors and delinquencies.
Well, I can come up to the table and check in other countries, but I have at least other countries that we operate that those correlations are not statistically significant. They seem to be, they appear to be, but when you go down to test an actual portfolio, they do not behave so well. So I would like this to be well behaved, as is implied in this model. That would make my life easier. Okay, but it's at least in most part countries in that we operate, that's not true. So I'd be very careful that.
Okay. Well, but still,
I'm not hearing for some
we take the point. Other comments?
Peter here at Tefrag. In our field test, we're finding a big difference between the large banks that are on internal rating-based systems and everybody else. I think the very large banks with internal rating-based systems based on Basel, they have a reasonable amount of data that they can work with that they need to modify. And as mentioned earlier, it's still costly, but they have something to work with. Just about everybody else that we encounter is essentially on a delinquency basis. So the 30-day practical expedient is essentially the way they appear to be running the model. Also, we've noticed that the smaller institutions, by and large, do not have very meaningful IFRS 9 budgets at the moment, and they have not really made great strides forward in trying to apply the model. So I think in your field test, you need to be very mindful of a sort of canary wharf bias in your testing.
We've been quite conscious of trying to have a range of sizes and sophistications of banks in our field work. So I think it's not a canary wharf bias, I think, in our field work, and we'll bring that across in the feedback that we give on the field work.
And also what we have seen also from large banks, on retail portfolios, they are looking at delinquencies and they don't have really high sophisticated models with include the ratings of individual retail customers. That is not the case. And I think the main problem what we have seen is, okay, how to, for retail portfolios, if you don't have this individual assessment, how to bring into this calculation then macroeconomic factors and forward-looking stuff. And I think we need to give some more guidance on that, and that is why one of the learnings which we had from the field there. So I agree with you, Peter.
More comments?
This is a short comment for delinquency and discount rate for measuring credit losses. Regarding delinquency, we are concerned that having a bright line approach using 30 days is troublesome. One single bright line is troublesome, but more than one bright line is more troublesome. So we don't think we need a bright line for delinquency. Regarding discount rate, we are concerned about the flexibility given to discount rates. This is because by using a discount rate other than EIR, elements other than credit risk will be reflected in the measurement of the expected credit losses. Thanks.
Maybe I risk to that, because 30 days is really not a bright line, it is a simplification. So you can really use better information. We had, for example, in the field there are some banks which use 5 days past due, so that is not in the exposure draft, that is a bright line. It's only a simplification. If you don't have any better information, then you can use 30 days. But it is not a bright line.
Yes, but I think we have to make clearer, there is a danger that it will be used as a bright line.
That's maybe, yeah.
That is a danger that has also been identified by the prudential regulators, and we agree with that.
Yes.
So we will make sure that this is just a help, but that does not mean that when the economy worsens significantly, when unemployment goes up, when there is a steep interest rate hike, that banks can wait for 30-day delinquency to go up before they start taking provisions on their portfolios, which they know are coming.
Answers, Peter. On the 30-day delinquency, the numbers we have seen from banks indicate that by the time you hit a 30-day delinquency, your probability of default is around 20%, slightly lower, slightly higher. So I think normally once you hit the 30-day delinquency, you will not be able to rebut the impairment, I think, based on the data we've seen. I think if anything, it might be a bit shorter. I think by the time you hit 60 days or 90 days, the probability of default goes up to 40 to 80%. So even if people do not like the 30-day quote-unquote bright line, I don't get the impression that it's too early. The one exception would perhaps be corporate lending.
And the problem is if you do it only on the 30 days, that is only forward-looking, and I think what we have to do, we have to come up how we factor into this if you do it on delinquencies, if we have then forward-looking information of the economy is worsening and how in a retail portfolio, if you use delinquency, how you should do that. Because if you do it only on 30 days, I would agree that it's only looking back and it's not anyhow looking forward.
Mm. And to that point, I think a lot of less sophisticated institutions, essentially everybody who's not a big Basel IRB bank, is leaning very heavily on delinquency information.
Although I think the 30 days is a stopgap, it should be possible to predict that deterioration well before that 30-day period arrives.
Yeah, but the issue that we're finding is that banks on a standardized approach and all other constituents, they basically don't have those models or those systems.
Yeah, it's the Denise on from Canada. I would reiterate that. We've got a comment letter from smaller institutions. They're on the standardized approach. They don't have that information. So I would reiterate the comments that everybody else is making relative to how people are going to approach the 30-day and how they're going to interpret it. So I do agree with you, Hans, that you need to make it clear that it's not a bright line. That's pretty important.
Just a couple of comments from an Australian perspective. I'm looking at some statistics here that age across, and there's a particular bank, a large bank. What it shows is there's an enormous drop back from the 39-day overdue category back into current. More go back that way than go forward into the 60-89 day. So I think you're going to have to get people to use their judgment on that one, and I think Hans's point of making sure that it's not seen as a bright line is about all that you can do. The other transitional issue gets back to what I said before. Tracing by instrument, I don't think is absolutely necessary for the principle that you're trying to achieve. And at least Australian banks don't have those tracing facilities by instrument. As sophisticated they are. So if it isn't instruments that have credit risk, it's customers that have credit risk. So if some refinement could be made to the wording there that didn't force people down an instrument by instrument basis, there would be far less systems issues than otherwise. A final observation about transition and so on, and it's just an observation. This is going to be an unusual document for entities that are thinking about whether they early adopt or adopt when the standard is required. I think you'll be in an unconscionable position if you've done the numbers and you don't early apply. I think that would be an extraordinarily risky position to put themselves in. So I just encourage you to think a little bit about the behavioural consequences of a long position.
Can we share our points with participants? We are from China. Excuse me?
Yes, hello, go on.
Okay, some preliminary views from Ministry of Finance China, rather than formal comments, which is coming very soon. There are four points. One, we basically support the general model of credit risk deterioration proposed by the ED. Two, we support the proposed simplification for the trade receivables and the lease receivables, but we encourage ISB to think about how to treat the trade receivables resulting from transactions under the IAS 11. Three, we can apply this model proposed by the ED to the mandatory ISB OCI category, because we are proposing introducing a exemption or an option like what in the FASB proposal. Allow the reporting entities to choose whether they are using this model or they just use fair value, because of course we can define what the qualified assets like fair value is larger than the carrying amount and the credit risk is low, something like this. Because the reason is we have noted that it's really hard for the reporting entities other than financial institutions to establish their own system to collect data to satisfy the model, the proposed model. This is the third point. Four, we appreciate the ISB provide more guidance on some significant definition, like the credit risk is low and the significant decrease, something like this, and how to consider the forward-looking factors in the PD and LGD, something like this, because we have noted the current guidance in the ED and the application guidance is inadequate. That's all. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Lu Guanghong. Any other comments? Hello? Was there anybody? No? Russ, is there perhaps in the last 5 minutes that we have, would you like to give a brief impression of the feedback that you have been receiving on your model?
Hans, is that a question to me?
Yes, please.
Consistent with what Sue Lloyd said, I would say the majority of the U.S. investors are supportive of a more forward-looking, similar to a lifetime loss. I believe most preparers are concerned about the operationality of that, and they're also concerned about the impact on regulatory capital, i.e. the day one debit to expense. I would say by far all of our stakeholders, whether it be investors, preparers, or auditors, are promoting convergence and asking us to work with the ISV to come to a converged solution here. So I'm encouraged by the fact that both boards are working together and to try to come up with a converged solution here.
Okay, thank you, Russ. Well, obviously everybody knows that we will have a joint board meeting in the, I think, the third week of July, where we will be discussing impairment jointly. Unless anybody has a last-minute contribution or question, I would like to call this meeting to a close. And I want to thank you for your participation and contribution. And we look forward to our next physical meeting in September.
Thank you very much.
Okay,
thank you.
Goodbye, bye, bye.